The Nation of Immigrants narrative has real value, I think, in understanding the United States and its history as a nation that has welcomed people throughout the last 250 years. And at the same time, it leaves out many people, and it also leaves out many parts of the story, including that of the exclusive nature in which people have been admitted to the country and allowed to remain.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host for the next hour. The speaker you just heard was Adam Goodman, author of The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. The book is a 2020 publication from Princeton University Press. Our show this morning is devoted to a rebroadcast of an episode from Against the Grain, in which Sasha Lilly speaks with Adam Goodman about the history of immigration and deportation in the United States. Goodman discusses how immigration policy in this nation of immigrants has been deployed to both control the labor market in the interests of capital and to control a different kind of market, the marketplace of ideas. Immigrants may be a source of cheap and easily intimidated labor, but they are also a source of ideas that challenge dominant narratives. Undocumented persons have long been subject to expulsion for the ways they think. The current wave of deportations of persons speaking out against genocide in Gaza is anything but a departure from past immigration policies and practices. Against the Grain is a weekly radio show hosted and produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song on KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. It's a program of ideas, in-depth analysis, and commentary on political, economic, social, and cultural issues important to radical thinking and activism. This episode on immigration originally aired on May 28. Before we get rolling, I regret to inform our listeners that the shutdown of the Corporation of Public Broadcasting will result in the loss of monies to KBOO that represent 10% of our budget. KBOO will need to rely more than ever on the generous contributions of our listeners and supporters. If you can, please donate to keep local community radio alive and kicking. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. Now, without further delay, here is Sasha Lilly with Adam Goodman.
Today on Against the Grain, the United States has often been celebrated as a nation of immigrants. Yet over the last century, the U.S. government expelled more people than were allowed to stay permanently. Historian Adam Goodman describes the U.S. state's deportation machine, motivated by a shifting combination of bureaucratic self-interest, capitalist gain, and racism, which Trump has now put at the center of his presidency. He also discusses how immigrants and their allies have fought back over this long history of expulsion and terror. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Trump's efforts to terrorize and deport immigrants, undocumented and documented, have rightly drawn widespread opprobrium. but the U.S. government has expelled and driven out immigrants since the country's founding, totaling a mind-boggling 60 million deportees over the last century alone, which is the subject of Adam Goodman's The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. He teaches history and Latin American and Latino studies at the University of Illinois Chicago. Adam, it's a commonplace that the U.S. is a nation of immigrants, which of course omits Native people and those who were brought here in chains. But certainly the majority of Americans, or their families, are or were once immigrants. What does the story of a nation of immigrants obscure?
The nation of immigrants narrative has real value, I think, in understanding the United States and its history as a nation that has welcomed people throughout the last 250 years. And at the same time, it leaves out many people, and it also leaves out many parts of the story, including that of the exclusive nature in which people have been admitted to the country and allowed to remain. But first and foremost, as you alluded to in the question itself, is the fact that the nation of immigrants narrative doesn't account for indigenous people already living in this land, nor does it account for those who didn't come by choice. I think there's an inherent idea behind the nation of immigrants narrative that this is a story of one way, mostly if not entirely European migration around the turn of the 20th century, of people searching for a better life and economic betterment for themselves and their families. And that, in fact, is just a small portion of the history of immigration to the United States, or the history of immigration and migration more broadly. There are many reasons why people migrate, certainly for economic reasons, but also for any number of other reasons, including to reunite with family, to escape political persecution or violence, fleeing the aftermath of natural disaster. So the nation of immigrants narrative, I think there is some truth to it, as there is to many myths and stereotypes. And yet at the same time, it perhaps obscures just as much as it reveals.
So right now, that the narrative of being a nation of immigrants is certainly being challenged by the kind of nativism of the Trump administration. And we are seeing the ramping up of deportations of people who are in the U.S. without papers, along with people who are here legally and even some U.S. citizens. And this is being done through the formal apparatus of the state. And I wanted to ask you, we'll certainly talk a lot more about the Trump administration and where you place it in the longer sweep of history. But I wanted to ask you, when we think about people being forced out of the United States, how much of it takes place through that formal government apparatus?
It's a great question, and it's one that I kind of went into this project asking myself and realizing that, in fact, 85% or more of all people expelled from the United States during the last century and a half have been forced or coerced into leaving through informal measures and mechanisms, euphemistically termed phrases or, means of expulsion such as voluntary departure, in which there's nothing voluntary all about them, as well as fear campaigns and scare tactics meant and to encourage people or to coerce people into leaving on their own through so-called self-deportation. And these two mechanisms that I trace throughout the book actually represent the experiences of most of the people who have left the country during that time period, and they continue to remain incredibly relevant today. So the formal deportations, and I think the idea many people have, many listeners might have, is that when someone is apprehended and facing deportation, they kind of have their day in court in front of an immigration judge. They're able to plead their case, and whatever the court decides, there's kind of a just, fair process. And the reality is that most people never have that opportunity. And over time, the consequences of being deported have become harsher. But the expedited, streamlined nature of deportation has only become more important, I think. And in some sense, deportation without due process has long been the American way.
Well, as I mentioned, we'll talk more as we go about the Trump administration. But I guess I just have to ask you then, with these highly publicized cases of people being scooped up and put on planes and deported to, you know, Gulag in El Salvador. That has seemed very shocking to many people, that these people have been detained and deported from the country without any process. Certainly it's deplorable, but would you say that this is less remarkable than we might think, or is the form that it's taking still makes it something notable?
I'd say both, perhaps. There's a sense in which, you know, we have seen this before, in the fact that, you know, the streamlined expedited expulsion mechanisms that the immigration bureaucracy has long relied on remain at play today. And I think we see kind of the current administration ramping up those efforts, perhaps to previously unknown levels. But what I do think we see is that, just as in the past, the current administration is trying every possible way to skirt legal limitations and to expand the authority of the executive branch and of the federal government to apprehend, detain, and deport people. And that was true in the past, that remains true today. And perhaps today immigration is a more central issue than at any other time in the past. And the Trump administration has made it so. And that's, I think, you know, something of note.
And just to clarify, so you said there are three different ways that the United States expels people, and formal deportation is what most of us picture, and you were just speaking about that, that actually that happens over time, the fewest of the cases, which is that you have your day in court in front of an immigration judge. And then you mentioned voluntary departure and also fear campaigns, where people effectively self-deport out of fear. Can you talk more about, just so we understand the different categories before we go further, voluntary departure, which you said is anything but voluntary, is different than somebody just leaving because they fear they might be apprehended. Can you explain what happens once someone is detained but then leaves so-called voluntarily rather than through this formal deportation apparatus?
I appreciate you following up on this particular point, because the terminology is incredibly confusing, and perhaps intentionally so, some might argue. So as you say, and what I spent a lot of time thinking about this and how to translate this to readers to help them understand the differences between the three different primary mechanisms of expulsion throughout U.S. history. So voluntary departure, these are essentially administrative expulsions. People are not choosing to leave the country. Voluntary departures occur after an immigration agent has apprehended someone. I think that's the first key piece that can help people understand what I'm trying to say here. So they happen after an apprehension, and an immigration agent provides the apprehended individual with a series of different options, including leaving the country on their own, supposedly, through this administrative expulsion mechanism, sometimes having to pay their way to do so, in order to avoid extended periods in detention, in order to avoid more severe consequences and repercussions of being deported, including multi-decade bars on reentry, potentially, or lifetime bans on reentry. So it's an incentivized system in which people are encouraged by the system and by agents, sometimes coerced or tricked, in fact, historically, by agents into signing voluntary departure forms and giving up their rights, whatever rights they might have, to fight their case and fight to stay in the country. And so, you know, we've seen this throughout history, that this is what largely immigration agents have relied on to expel mostly Mexicans and some Canadians as well, and some others from Central America, in particular in the 1980s. But at the same time, you know, we've seen that formal deportations, so the more traditional idea people have, I think, where migrants do have their day in court, although sometimes that day might be one in which they're partaking in a mass hearing, in which an immigration judge is hearing 30 cases at once, kind of these batch hearings. So, you know, that kind of gives you a sense of, you know, how little people really are able to get into the particulars of their cases. Formal deportations have come to resemble voluntary departures in their streamlined nature. So there are different mechanisms that the immigration bureaucracy has created in the last 30 years or so, since 1996. And one of them is called, one of these means is called expedited removal. Expedited removal mirrors or kind of very much looks like voluntary departure in terms of the streamlined nature, but the consequences are harsher. So, I think that there's been a bit of a slippage between these categories, but what is true is that there's been this impulse to keep the system moving and, to not slow down the deportation machine. And the only way to do that, because of budgetary constraints, because of logistical constraints, is to rely on these expedited means and mechanisms of expulsion. And just one last thing I'll add here to help people understand the idea of voluntary departure. What I liken it to in the book are the role that plea bargains play in the criminal justice system. I think voluntary departures play a similar role in the immigration system, so that most cases in the criminal justice system never make it to trial because, people are threatened with, long prison sentences. So they agree to a lesser offense and a lesser penalty. And I think that we might be able to understand voluntary departures using that analogy.
And then lastly, you say that although 85% of deportations happen through the process that you've just described, the so-called voluntary departures, and then some portion of them through the more formal mechanisms of the courts, then the third way that you say people get forced out are through fear campaigns, which we've seen throughout U.S. history. And they haven't been apprehended, but they're in fear of being apprehended and leave preemptively. Can we actually measure how many people leave or have left historically through self-deportation by fearing apprehension and leaving?
No, we can't. And, I spent a lot of time kind of digging into the numbers and searching for reports through the immigration bureaucracy's archives, the National Archives, different agency administrative records, the records of migrant aid organizations, et cetera. But, self-deportations or people deciding to leave on their own preemptively without ever having come into contact with an immigration official necessarily, these we can't calculate or quantify. Now, we know that they exist. We know that they have, formed an essential component of the deportation machine since before the federal government had control over immigration in the United States. So the story I trace in the book, in the first chapter, in fact, is that the more informal means of expulsion predate the formal deportation machine as we've come to know it during the last century and a half. So at the local level, there are communities on the West Coast, say, in places like California, Truckee, California, for anyone who knows that area in the Sierra Nevada and close to Tahoe, where a man there by the name of Charles McGlashan kind of pioneered on these early self-deportation campaigns against Chinese immigrants who are living in Truckee. And again, the thought here is to basically make people's lives so miserable or in fact impossible that they decide to pick up and leave preemptively. And this was seen as a cost-saving measure at the time and still today. And, this is something that after the federal government gained control over immigration in the last decade of the 19th century, I thought that potentially, this mechanism would kind of fall to the wayside. But in fact, what happened was once formal deportations existed, then they could use formal deportations, the immigration officials could use formal deportations and the threat of formal deportation as a way to get people to either agree to voluntary departure or as a potential threat in hopes that they would pick up and leave on their own. So that's how I came to uncover the three mechanisms of the deportation machine, which, have been in operation now for a century and a half, remain active today. And I think each of the mechanisms has existed across time, but which ones have come to be the preferred mechanisms of the immigration bureaucracy has changed over time. So right now, I think we could see that the government's relying on all three of them, but especially on the self-deportation efforts through fear campaigns and kind of scare tactics. That is an absolutely essential piece of understanding the Trump administration's immigration enforcement efforts.
Historian Adam Goodman is my guest. We're discussing The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, you just said that since the inception of the United States, people have been expelled through different means. But in the very latter part of the 19th century, a bureaucracy was set up. A federal immigration bureaucracy was established. Why was it deemed necessary at the time?
In the late 19th century, there's a decentralized immigration admission and enforcement system. You know, this was something that took place at the state level, and there are different policies that existed in different states. The late 19th century, after the decades after the Civil War, you see the growth of the federal state, the growth of the federal bureaucracy, and kind of the growing administrative state in the late 19th and into the 20th century resulted in the creation of new agencies. And also, this was coupled with the fact that if we look at this particular historical conjuncture, that there's just a real explosion of the number of people who are coming to the United States. So you do have many Chinese labor migrants and, you know, those seeking to reunite with family coming to the West Coast primarily. You also have, you know, millions upon millions of Southern and Eastern European immigrants coming to the East Coast and, you know, then moving across the country, heading westward. And, you know, in part, this was kind of a time of tremendous economic growth, and there are real labor demands and labor needs. There's also labor recruitment that took place by U.S. companies, and they needed a more, I guess, singular way or universal way to manage the admission of who was coming, and then manage, who was allowed to remain. And, you know, this became more prominent as the early decades of the 20th century went on, and there were concerns about political radicals and different things that, I think people could relate to today in terms of, the beliefs that immigrants held being seen as a potential threat, national security threat to the country during the Mexican Revolution, during the Russian Revolution, during World War I. And so the centralized immigration bureaucracy came to grow dramatically over the course of the first half of the 20th century, especially, but it remained relatively small until recent decades. And I think that's worth noting as well. But the bureaucratic control and the growth of the immigration bureaucracy play an essential role in the story that I tell. I think that, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily realize this, but, you know, as soon as the bureaucracy is set up and meant to regulate admissions as well as expulsions, then there's a kind of a vested interest in immigration enforcement and the bureaucracy needing to kind of sustain itself, you know, make congressional budget requests each year and to justify those budget requests by showing, you know, what they accomplished. And what were those accomplishments? Well, you know, there might have been screenings of people seeking to come into the country, but also was, you know, apprehensions and deportations. And so they had a vested interest in carrying out immigration enforcement actions. And that's something that we see to be more true even over time.
Well, how did this bureaucracy of immigration enforcement relate to capital in mid-century? You mentioned how labor procurement has been part of this story, and thinking about from the Great Depression through, you know, the mid-20th century, obviously agricultural capital has relied on cheap labor as an essential dimension of their business model. And having people who can be exploited has taken different ways. In mid-century, there was the Bracero program, so-called guest worker program, that operated as a way of bringing in labor. What is the relationship, what has been the relationship between the immigration bureaucracy and these powerful groups who have employed agricultural and other labor who might require workers? Is it as simple as a kind of tug of war between the two, or have, say, agricultural interests actually benefited from a bureaucracy that would put people in fear of being deported as a way of controlling labor effectively?
A great question, and I would say it's both. On the one hand, there have been moments, you know, throughout history when, I guess, agricultural interests, industrial interests, mining interests have depended on and actively sought out, I should add, cheap, exploitable immigrant labor. And, you know, that's something that they have, you know, needed from their perspective, and something that they've relied on the immigration service across time to provide or to allow for. And so there's some cases been kind of a nod and wink agreement, and instances throughout the 20th century, for example, as well, when kind of payday came around at the end of, a period of labor in which the immigration service would mysteriously just show up by coincidence, you know? And, you know, in many of those instances, in fact, the growers or the bosses had called the immigration service so that they wouldn't have to pay their workers. And they'd have that kind of free labor. Forget about exploitable labor, it's just, you know, completely free labor in those instances. But at the same time, there are times when, you know, the immigration service and business interests were working kind of against one another or at odds with one another. You know, and the example that comes to mind here is in the 1950s when there were the mass expulsion campaigns during the Bracero program, you know, known by the derogatory term Operation Wetback, to refer to, you know, the migrants who crossed the Rio Grande River in the Texas borderlands and when they entered the United States. But this was a campaign in which there was a real crackdown on Mexican migrants and, you know, those living in the country that, you know, ended up leading to the apprehension and deportation of hundreds of thousands of people, including citizens, U.S. citizens of Mexican descent. And, you know, at this time, a lot of the growers in places like South Texas, say, were furious with Immigration Service, going as far as to liken them to the Nazis and the Gestapo, who are coming to, you know, to get their laborers out of the fields. You know, they very much did not want Immigration Service to interfere with the free flow of labor. And people who at that time had been coming perhaps, you know, to work on their farms and in their fields for years or even decades. I do think that the relationship is both, it depends on the time and the place. It's difficult to generalize, and that's why kind of the specificity of those kind of moments or, you know, conjunctures, you need to be taken on a case-by-case basis. But since you did bring up kind of this relationship and the question about, bureaucracy and capital, I should note that I think, you know, sometimes I get questions about, you know, what was fueling the deportation machine or what's behind the deportation machine. And I think, you know, those are two of the primary, drivers, kind of the bureaucratic interests that I've described, as well as kind of the capitalist interests and impulses for cheap exploitable labor. And then also kind of racist imperatives. Well, it's not any one of those. It's really all three in concert with one another that I think help us understand how and why punitive immigration policies have been propagated across time.
Ah, el único llanero que canta dembow, mamá. Dímelo, Luzzo. Ah, Donald Trump, yo no quiero que tú me deportes. Yo solo quiero papel y me sellen el pasaporte. Te prometo que trabajo y me presento en todas las cortes. Ando en busca de una gringa para casarme aquí en el norte. Un aporte que brindo para la nación. Lo primero fue la cita que me hizo migración. Sigo normas, sigo leyes, cambio la construcción. Lo menos que me merezco es una deportación. Donald Trump, Donald.
That soundbite you just heard was from a song called Donaltron by Venezuelan rappers Junior Caldera, Davecito 59, and Luxor, rapping in protest against the immigration policies of Donald Trump. In English, the lyrics include the lines, I contribute to this nation, I follow the law, I work in construction, I don't deserve to be deported. Before that, Sasha Lilly was speaking with immigration historian Adam Goodman. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Now we return to Sasha Lilly with Adam Goodman.
Well, you mentioned a short while ago that Mexicans in particular have been a key target for expulsion. And while various national groups have been targeted by different administrations at different times, Mexicans make up half of the undocumented immigrant population, but have accounted for 9 out of every 10 deportees. Why is that?
I think it has a lot to do with the historical geographical realities. Just the fact that the U.S. and Mexico are neighbors, and that there's long been labor demand as well as kind of inequalities across the two countries when it comes to the economy. That goes a long way to describing, I think, perhaps why there is such a attention to and crackdown on migration across the U.S.-Mexico border. But it also has, something to do with the immigration bureaucracy itself, and the conscious decision to police the U.S.-Mexico border differently. Without going too far down this rabbit hole, it's worth noting that immigrant labor has long been an essential part of the United States, and something that employers and the nation, consumers as well, have relied on. But over the course of time, the late 19th, early 20th century, there's a paring back because of laws and policies that were implemented by Congress and the executive branch as to who could come to the United States. So after Chinese exclusion went into effect, after migration from Asia was barred essentially, for most laborers, at least, those with economic means could still come in many instances, but laborers could no longer come after the 1924 Immigration Act. That same act, which implemented a national origins quota system, severely limiting, who could come from Southern and Eastern Europe. These targeted policies meant that all of a sudden, many of the migrants who had provided, many of the countries that had provided migrants, who labored in the United States, could no longer enter the United States with authorization. So what did employers do? They looked south to Mexico. Now, the Western Hemisphere was not included in those restrictions and limitations in the 1924 Immigration Act. And not everyone was happy about that. So employers certainly were, and kind of big business friendly congressmen from the South were, who were listening to their powerful constituents, but others weren't. And so even though the Western Hemisphere wasn't included in the 1924 Immigration Act and those national origins quotas, at the same time, they kind of threw a bone, Congress threw a bone to those who were adamant about including Mexicans and others in the Western Hemisphere, and they created the Border Patrol, just days after, in fact, the Border Patrol is created. And so because migrant labor was cut off from most of the rest of the world, and Mexicans, because of the geographical proximity, provided kind of an easy source of the much needed labor, they came to be targeted increasingly over time by immigration officials. And, I think today we can see that as well. I mean, the composition of who is migrating has changed dramatically, but I think of the 20,000 or so Border Patrol agents in the United States, 18,000 are stationed on the U.S.-Mexico border. And that's to say only 2,000 on the even longer U.S.-Canada border, and that doesn't include the east and west coasts along the seaports.
We are seeing again the heightened expulsion of immigrants for political reasons. In this case, people opposing U.S. support for Israel's genocide against the Palestinians. What has been the history of the U.S. state expelling people for political reasons? You mentioned in the early 20th century, there were fears of immigrants bringing radical ideas with them.
People have long been targeted for political reasons and their political views. It's not the majority or even a large number necessarily, of immigrants across U.S. history compared to those who have been targeted, because they're simply in the country without authorization, or for crossing the border without authorization, or for overstaying a visa. The vast majority of people apprehended and deported, simply don't have their immigration status aligned with, the current standards. But in many cases across time, we have seen these really prominent cases. So there's a disproportionate attention to the political targeting of immigrants. And I think that's, that's worth noting. And I think we're seeing that today as well. And it's worth noting kind of why people are targeted and how, what's deemed as a dangerous idea might change over time. But the fact that, those who are from other places or those who are potentially bringing to the country beliefs and ideas or organizing efforts to question, perhaps threaten, but even question the pre-existing norms and system of government as well as capital, oftentimes, catch the attention and interest of immigration authorities. So, we certainly saw that in the 19-teens, 1920s. You can think of, you know, famous cases like Emma Goldman, Alexander Berkman. But in the 1950s as well, you know, during the Red Scare, you know, many Mexican labor activists and organizers are targeted. And you know, I traced the story of one of those individuals, not in my book, but in a separate standalone article that I wrote for the journal Labor, Rodolfo Lozoya, you know, who was excluded from the United States. He's a trade unionist and organizer here in Chicago, has a, you know, a U.S. citizen wife, seven U.S. citizen kids, and he's kept out of the country because of his political organizing and activism and alleged membership in the Communist Party. And when I submitted FOIA requests, the Freedom of Information Act requests to the federal government to get information on Lozoya's file, you know, who has since died, so they were able to provide that, you know, to me, hundreds of pages it ended up being, although it did take, I forget how many years now, I lost track, but, you know, 4 or 5 years. And when I got those files, many of kind of the basic pieces of information were still redacted, including those which would let one know that he had U.S. citizen family members. And I found that to be really interesting, but also, you know, found interesting kind of the specter of kind of political radicalism that still hangs over, you know, the government today, and, you know, what and why they're targeting some individuals. I think we can see as a through line across history, even if they don't represent very many people who are targeted for expulsion, their cases are prominent. Just like Mahmoud Khalil today and others, and I think, you know, deserve, you know, serious attention and scrutiny, and point to the fact that there's long been a tension between national security and civil liberties and individual liberties when it comes to, you know, where to draw the line on immigration. And in recent decades, especially since 9/11, 2001, I think, you know, we've seen kind of a dramatic move toward shoring up national security interests at all costs. And the best way to kind of expel someone and to, you know, squash any kind of dissent or possibility of them being able to stay in the country is to, you know, to label them a terrorist, or to label them an alien enemy, or to label them a gang member, et cetera, as we've seen the current administration do in recent months.
Right. And interestingly, drawing on some archaic laws from the past, including from the McCarthy era. I'm speaking with historian Adam Goodman. We are talking about his book, The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I wanted to ask you, you know, you argue that we can't really understand both the kinds of ways that the state has pushed to expel people from this country, and also the ways that people have resisted and organized to push back, without seeing them in historical context. And I wanted to ask you about one reoccurring theme, which is a sense that gets generated, often kind of fanned by the state, of a crisis situation. Can you tell us about, in our more recent times, the creation of the narrative of the immigration crisis that can't be ignored?
This is a key piece to understanding how the executive branch has gained tremendous authority over immigration. And I think, you know, driving a crisis narrative provides kind of the groundwork to then request or to demand or, you know, to make a strong case for increased funding or unlimited funding to control the crisis, to you know, resolve the crisis, to address it, et cetera. So it's something that's done strategically, but oftentimes it's of the government's own making. They manufacture the crisis. So, you know, I can give an example here, concrete example, which has played out at different moments in time. It's kind of the political use of immigration statistics. So in the 1960s and 70s, which I describe as the dawn of the age of mass expulsion, immigration authorities strategically had a system in which they would deport people via voluntary departure. Those same people would return to the United States to reunite with their family or to return to their place of employment, because at that time the border was a lot more porous. It was easier to get back in. And, you know, there's a side note here. I don't want to say that this was a time period and a process that didn't have any kind of consequences for migrants. I think there were serious consequences, human cost to migrants during this time. And I argue that forcefully in the book, where others, I think, have said that this was just kind of an agreement people had and it wasn't so much of a big deal. I don't think that's true. But what happened was, through this revolving door effect, the number of people apprehended each year and deported each year skyrockets. So from the late 1970s to the early 2000s, you have an average of around 900,000 people per year who are apprehended and deported almost entirely, more than 90%, through voluntary departure. Okay. And, you know, this on the one hand served the needs of the immigration service, although the agents on the ground weren't happy with it because it meant that they were seeing the same people multiple times. But it did create this crisis narrative of a border out of control. We saw that as well during the previous administration, during the Biden years. And I think a lot of that crisis that emerged, that was created, manufactured, whether purposefully or not, you know, had to do with how the Biden administration was handling those who were on the border, the so-called encounters on the border. It was the same effect of, you know, the same people being apprehended on multiple occasions. So they weren't unique individuals, with each time, but there ends up being millions of people. And I think, you know, this leads to the sense of, you know, the nation not having control or having lost control of its borders and of its immigration system and everything that that entails. So what comes out of that are calls for harsher enforcement, calls for more immigration agents, calls for millions upon millions of dollars more, and now it's billions upon billions of dollars more to address the so-called crisis. And you see how this serves the ends of the bureaucracy while also exacting a real cost on the people who find themselves caught up in the machine.
I'd like to ask you about the 1996 Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, which was signed by Bill Clinton, part of his tough on crime politics, and that you write that no other law has shaped immigration policy as much over the last half century as it. So in terms of trying to understand where we are now, what did it allow authorities to do?
So IRA, as it's sometimes referred to, you can't make up these names either. You know, the illegal, I mean, as you said, it's just, you know, the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act. So this particular law made it a lot easier to deport more people than ever before. And so it expanded the number of deportable offenses. It made it straightforward to deport people who are accused of even minor crimes and offenses. It could be shoplifting, could be traffic violations, that all of a sudden found themselves caught up in the deportation machine. And a key piece of this as well was that these new terms under the act were applied retroactively. So someone who might have, you know, pled to an offense years prior now found that that offense could lead to their deportation after the 1996 Immigration Act. It ramped up the funding for enforcement, which we see as a kind of continuous theme across recent years and decades, and is only going to get worse in the years ahead, no doubt. And I think that in this 1996 Act, you can see also ensnared up ensnaring many permanent residents, people in the country with legal status, something that's probably on people's minds today as well, given recent actions by the federal government. And so this was, a law, as you noted, signed by Democrat Bill Clinton. And it points to the fact as well that the deportation machine has this long bipartisan history. And, the current alignment, actually, I don't even know how we should think of it, because the Democrats, keep on moving closer and closer to the Republicans on this issue. But, things have become much more restrictive over time. But there's been a lot of agreement, certainly about enforcement first policies by both Democrats and Republicans. Things have not always been as polarized as they have come to be in the last decade or so. I think that's important to remember as well.
I'm speaking with historian Adam Goodman. We're talking about the history of mass deportations in the United States. So staying with that question of the Democrats, the Obama administration was noted for the record number of formal deportations during his time in office. And I wanted to ask you, how much of what we're seeing now, Trump's ramping up, first in his first term, but especially in this term, and of course, as you said, billions of dollars now being allocated for so-called immigration enforcement, how much of what we're seeing now is kind of an intensification of past policies, including of Obama and Biden, and how much do you think of it as a break?
You know, this is the key questions for historians, but I also think people who are interested in politics and policy. I think we certainly see continuity across time, whether it's kind of the mechanisms that the government and different administrations have relied on, or the fact that, kind of these questions of what's driving the machine, as we discussed earlier. And at the same time, I think it's really important to kind of zoom in and understand the particular historical, political, economic context of any one moment in time. And certainly what I don't want to say is that, there's just kind of continuity and an inevitability to all of this. I think, there are particular policies and actions put in place and taken over the course of the last century and a half that have created the deportation machine we have today. And a different set of policies and actions could lead us in a different direction in the future. I'm not saying that's necessarily likely at this moment in time, but I do think it's really important to understand as people who have organized on behalf of migrant communities and migrants themselves, first and foremost, clearly understand that, there are weak spots and weak points in the deportation machine, and applying as much pressure to them as possible, it's essential. So, one of the things I would say though that is perhaps a change is that, two things in fact. One thing is that the consequences of being deported have never been so punitive and so harsh. The separation that deportation represents today is much more permanent than it was in the past. I think, we really need to reckon with that and understand that. The borders of the world are harder today than they were in the past. And they've, become so incrementally over time. But a second thing that I've been thinking about a lot recently, given kind of some of the through lines, the continuities, is, how is the Trump administration different? And one thing I would say is that they're not the first administration, or Trump isn't the first politician, certainly, to use immigration for their own political ends, to scapegoat immigrants, to blame them, for all the problems that people face. And in fact, these are real problems. That's in part why this strategy is successful and why it resonates, is because people do have real problems that they need politicians and leaders to address. But instead of addressing them, it's much easier to scapegoat immigrants. So Trump isn't the first to do that, but this might be the administration, the first time an administration has made immigration the central issue, kind of the central issue that they are relying on and always, shining a light on for their own political ends. Again, I think can't be emphasized enough. And, that's different than the past, where immigration has been an issue, sometimes a key issue, but I don't know if it ever before has been the central issue. And that's something that I think we need to think about more and we need to understand more.
What do you think are Trump's ultimate intentions with this drive to deport immigrants, to make immigration the central issue? How much of it is about actually effectively trying to force out millions of undocumented people at, an incredible expense? How much of it is about making himself look strong and tough and so on? How much of it is about frightening and disempowering the undocumented? Because at the beginning of Trump's term, there was the revelation that the ICE website was releasing press releases from years past under the Obama administration, the Biden administration, to look like more people were being arrested by ICE than actually were. So, it does appear like looking like he's serious is a big part of the push. But, if he were able to achieve expulsions at the level that he's talking about, wouldn't that just paralyze crucial industries in the United States, like construction, like agriculture? How do you understand his ultimate intentions here? Can we understand it?
I think, first and foremost, he's interested in, number one, himself, and maintaining his power and control and authority. And immigration, presents one way to do that. And it's been very successful. I think no one can, contradict that. He's been incredibly successful in using immigration as a wedge issue that has pitted communities against one another, that has impeded solidarities, class-based solidarities across different racial and ethnic groups potentially. And you hear him refer time and again to how immigrants are coming and taking, what he calls black jobs. And that's, really strategically and cynically framed. And I think that he's found that this has been an effective tool to win elections, to maintain power. So I think, Trump himself, my instinct, and I obviously don't know exactly what he's thinking, but my instinct that is that he has used it effectively in the past and continues to use it effectively to try to kind of keep people's attention on scapegoating immigrants. And again, as I said, not on all the other real issues that they're potentially facing or other policies that he's implementing that are less popular. And part of what's baked into this approach is that immigration needs to remain a problem, so to speak, or it needs to remain kind of an ongoing and active issue that they focus on. They don't have an incentive to solve it, if we want to put it in those terms. And I think that's a choice that he's making to frame it as a problem. I don't think we need to think of it in that way. And a lot of times people don't realize that, but I do think that this is something that he's used really effectively. Others in his administration who are developing policy, and perhaps Trump himself, I'm not sure, I think have really clear views of who should come to the United States, who should remain in the United States, who is an American. And I think that's based on kind of both race and class, nationality. We've seen recent actions that I think have made that very clear. So I don't think there's any one answer to your question. I think there are probably many factors, as you elucidated. But more than anything, it's just been an incredibly effective political tool that he's used to the great detriment of millions of people, immigrants, permanent residents, citizens alike.
We've been talking through most of this interview about, the power of the state and allies of the state in frightening people, in deporting people formally, so-called voluntarily, making people leave the country because of fear. But that has not been the entire story of, 150 years of the United States deporting immigrants. It's also been a story, as you illustrate in your book, of resistance. And I wanted to ask you about what that kind of resistance has looked like in the more recent past, from the 1970s to now. What ways have immigrants and their allies deployed to fight back against this very powerful machine?
This is the other side of the story, which I think is so essential and gets a lot less attention in the media, perhaps, but it is really key to understanding because in the face of a century and a half of punitive policies, people have been navigating their way through, and they've been fighting back and they've been organizing. I think building broad-based coalitions has been essential across time. So migrants themselves, labor organizers, activists, lawyers, ordinary citizens, they've come together. They've taken to the streets, they've taken to the courts, and they've really pushed for change and led to real significant change, whether it's blocking people's individuals' deportation. There's a story I trace at a shoe factory in suburban Los Angeles in the late 1970s in which one of these coalitions of workers, lawyers, organizers, and activists, found themselves needed to defend a group of shoe factory workers, mostly from Mexico, who were apprehended on a May morning in 1978 when 40 immigration agents descended on the factory, surrounded it, apprehended everyone, kind of regardless of their legal status, just based on how they looked. And by, that same afternoon, most of the people were on buses to Mexico, heading to the border. But what they didn't know at that time, the people on the buses, was that during the same time that they were in detention and maybe being processed for voluntary departure, a group of these organizers and lawyers had filed an injunction in federal court and had stopped their deportation, and the buses were forced to turn around. This time they turned around, unlike the recent flights to El Salvador, which did not turn around. This time, the immigration authorities listened to the judge's orders and turned around. And many of those individuals were able to fight their cases with the help of this broad-based coalition. And there are around 60 people that were apprehended. Around half of those apprehended fought their cases. And 12, 13 years later, there's a class action lawsuit that resulted in expanded rights upon apprehension of more than a million people in the United States without status. So I think it's a good reminder that small coalitions and groups of people can lead to transformational change for millions. That remains true today. And I think we need to kind of insist on defending people's constitutional rights and redefining belonging in ways that transcend citizenship, that reflect the more lived realities of people, and kind of pushing back against this false binary of us and them, and recognizing that in fact we're all in this together.
Adam Goodman, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Adam Goodman teaches history and Latin American and Latino studies at the University of Illinois, Chicago. We've been discussing his book, The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
That does it for our show today. Thanks to Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song for permission to rebroadcast this episode of Against the Grain, which originally aired on KPFA in Berkeley on May 28th. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the past hour. I'm going to leave you this morning with more from Donaltron by Venezuelan rappers Caldera, Davecito 59, and Luxor. Join us again next Monday morning for more views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. Until then, stay safe and stay active.
Pagué por la novatada, pero me puse pa'l